From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We're here today to stand against the forces in America that value power over principle. Forces that attempted a coup against the legally expressed will of the American people by sowing doubt, inventing charges of fraud, seeking to steal the 2020 election from the people.
As President Biden pushes Senate Democrats to pass major voting rights legislation by changing the filibuster rules, we'll speak to Ari Berman of Mother Jones about what he calls the coming coup, how Republicans are laying the groundwork to steal future elections. Then, confessions of a human guinea pig. We'll talk to a Boston University professor who has resigned as a subject in Moderna's vaccine trials.
I enrolled in Moderna's vaccine trials because I wanted to play some small part in helping the world get out of this pandemic nightmare that we're in. Over the past few months, though, I've learned more about Moderna's terrible public health policies. And that's why I resigned from the trial, because I think that they need to prioritize not just the advancement of science, but public health rather than just advancing corporate profits.
Then John Nichols on his new book, Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers, Accountability for Those Who Caused the Crisis. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The World Health Organization says the number of confirmed coronavirus cases worldwide soared to 15 million last week, by far the highest weekly toll since the beginning of the pandemic. Countries across the globe, from Mexico to Argentina to the Philippines, have shattered previous records for new infections. Hospitalizations are rising rapidly in many places. In Canada, Quebec's premier said Tuesday he'll begin levying fines on adults who refuse to be vaccinated for non-medical reasons. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz told Parliament Wednesday he'd like to make vaccinations mandatory for all adults. In France, tens of thousands of unionized teachers have walked off the job to demand a coherent policy for COVID-19 in schools and to demand greater protections for teachers and students.
We have reached a level of exasperation, tiredness, and anger. We had no choice but to organize a large mobilization to send a strong message to the government.
In Britain, some senior members of Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party are calling on the Prime Minister to step down after Johnson admitted he attended a cocktail party at his official residence in May 2020 at a time when he'd ordered the UK into a strict coronavirus lockdown. Opposition parties also demanded Johnson resign. This is Labour Party leader Keir Starmer.
After months of deceit and deception, the pathetic spectacle of a man who's run out of road. His defence that he didn't realise he was at a party. It is so ridiculous that it's actually offensive to the British public. He's finally been forced to admit what everyone knew, that when the whole country was locked down, he was hosting boozy parties in Downing Street. Yes. Is he now going to do the decent thing and resign?
Across the pond, here in the United States, President Biden is announcing the deployment of 1,000 military medical personnel to six states where hospitals are overwhelmed with COVID-19 patients. The U.S. is averaging nearly 800,000 cases per day, a record high, and more than 145,000 U.S. hospital beds are filled by COVID patients, also a record number. Top infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci said Wednesday most U.S. residents will be exposed to coronavirus at some point.
Virtually everybody is going to wind up getting exposed and likely get infected. But if you're vaccinated and if you're boosted, the chances of you getting sick are very, very low.
California Governor Gavin Newsom has approved a policy change that will allow asymptomatic healthcare workers who've tested positive for coronavirus to return to work immediately. The president of the California Nurses Association, Kathy Kennedy, blasted the decision, writing, quote, "We need more infectious disease controls, not more casualties. Surging pandemic numbers are a warning to strengthen safety measures, not weaken them," she said. In West Virginia, Governor Jim Justice has called off plans to deliver his State of the State address after he tested positive for coronavirus. Justice's chief of staff said the 70-year-old Republican who is vaccinated and boosted is very ill with COVID-19 and suffering from elevated blood pressure and severe congestion. Republican Minority House Leader Kevin McCarthy said Wednesday he will not cooperate with the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The panel had asked McCarthy to voluntarily testify about Trump's state of mind in the run-up to the riot and in the week following the attack on Congress. McCarthy slammed the committee as illegitimate and said his private conversations with Trump were, quote, not remotely related to the violence that unfolded at the Capitol, unquote. President Trump cut short a telephone interview with National Public Radio Tuesday after he was repeatedly called out over his lies about the 2020 election. Trump hung up less than 9 minutes into what was supposed to have been a 15-minute interview with host Steve Inskeep after repeating conspiracy theories about Joe Biden's Electoral College win. NPR aired the exchange Wednesday.
You have to solve the problem of the presidential rigged election of 2020.
Mr. President, one more question. I want to ask about a court hearing yesterday on January 6th. Judge Amit Mehta, he's gone. Okay.
During the interview, Trump branded Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell a loser for failing to back Trump's unsupported claims about the election. On Capitol Hill, Biden is holding a lunchtime meeting today with Senate Democratic caucus. The White House is pressuring Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema to support a change to Senate rules that would allow Democrats to pass a pair of major voting rights bills with a simple majority, circumventing a Republican-led filibuster. On Wednesday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer outlined a plan to bring the voting bills to a debate using a parliamentary maneuver. The move would still leave room for Republicans to filibuster final passage of the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act and the Freedom to Vote Act. On Wednesday, Senate Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell blasted President Biden over his voting rights speech in Atlanta, Georgia earlier this week when Biden accused Republicans of siding with Jefferson Davis over Abraham Lincoln.
12 months ago, this president said disagreement must not lead to disunion. But yesterday he invoked the bloody disunion of the Civil War, to demonize Americans who disagree with him.
In 2015, an old photo emerged showing McConnell posing in front of a large Confederate flag at a Sons of Confederate Veterans event in the early 1990s. Ohio's Supreme Court has struck down a state House and Senate redistricting plan that's heavily gerrymandered by Republicans to preserve their supermajority in Ohio's state House. The court gave the Republican-dominated Ohio Redistricting Commission 10 days to submit a new plan after it determined the previous maps violated an anti-gerrymandering amendment to the Ohio Constitution. After headlines, we'll speak with Ari Berman of Mother Jones about the coming coup, how Republicans are laying the groundwork to steal future elections. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed an 80-year-old Palestinian-American man Wednesday. Witnesses say Omar Abdulmajid Assad was stopped by Israeli forces while driving home, then dragged out of the car, gagged and handcuffed and left to die. The U.S. State Department says it supports an investigation into the death of Assad, who holds U.S. citizenship. In other news from the region, Israel's Supreme Court ruled Tuesday the Interior Ministry cannot deny Palestinians who marry Israeli citizens the right of residency in Israel. A court in Germany has found a former Syrian intelligence officer guilty of crimes against humanity, wrapping up the first ever torture trial against a member of President Bashar al-Assad's regime. Anwar Raslan, a Syrian army colonel, was sentenced to life in prison after the court linked him to at least 4,000 instances of torture, dozens of murders, and 5 cases of sexual violence in Syria. Police arrested Raslan in Germany in 2019, with prosecutors citing the principle of universal jurisdiction for serious crimes. 5 more Guantanamo Bay prisoners have been approved for release. 3 of the men are from Yemen, 1 is Kenyan, and 1 is from Somalia. None have been charged with a crime. The Biden administration made the announcement earlier this week on the 20th anniversary of the prison's opening. Nearly half of the remaining 39 Guantanamo prisoners have now been approved for release, but that does not guarantee they will be freed soon, as the U.S. still needs to secure host countries to transfer them to. To see our hour-long discussion with a Muslim chaplain and two former Guantanamo prisoners, you can go to democracynow.org. In Somalia, a car bomb explosion in the capital, Mogadishu, killed 8 people and injured 9 others Wednesday in an attack claimed by al-Shabaab. The blast struck a road leading to Mogadishu's main international airport. It appeared to target a multi-vehicle private security convoy escorting foreigners. In New Mexico, Archbishop John Wester of Santa Fe has called for the abolition of nuclear weapons arsenals around the globe. In a pastoral letter released Tuesday, Wester says, quote, "To love our enemies means we have to begin the process of ending our preparations to kill them and doing everything we can not to harm them, but to actively love them, including the people of Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and others." Wester spoke to reporters in Santa Fe Tuesday.
The Catholic Church has a long history of speaking out against nuclear weapons. Indeed, the Vatican was the first nation state to sign and ratify the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. The Archdiocese of Santa Fe has a special role to play in advocating for nuclear disarmament, given the Los Alamos and Sandia nuclear weapons laboratories and the nation's largest repository of nuclear weapons at the Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque.
The Archbishop's letter came as a coalition of 60 groups issued a joint statement calling for the elimination of the hundreds of U.S. intercontinental ballistic nuclear missiles now armed and on hair trigger alert. A Texas sheriff is being investigated over reports he regularly ordered his deputies to seize cash and vehicles from undocumented motorists during traffic stops before transferring the individuals to U.S. Border Patrol. Real County Sheriff Nathan Johnson could face 2 to 10 years in prison and a fine if charged. In Colorado, around 8,400 workers across 77 Kroger's, King Supers in Denver and other areas went on strike Wednesday as they demand better wages and benefits and safe working conditions. During the pandemic, Kroger CEO Rodney McMullen's pay increased by over 45%, while the median pay for workers dropped by 8% despite booming sales. Workers also say stores are understaffed. A new report funded by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union reveals over 3/4 of Kroger's employees surveyed face food insecurity, and 14% have been unhoused over the past year. And in California, Governor Gavin Newsom unveiled a plan that would extend its state-sponsored health care program to all low-income undocumented residents. Currently, only undocumented Californians under the age of 26 can benefit from Medi-Cal, and later this year, undocumented people 50 and over will also be able to apply. Nearly 2/3 of undocumented Californians under the age of 65 currently do not have health insurance. Meanwhile, a new bill sponsored by the California Nurses Association that would guarantee single-payer universal health care cleared its first major hurdle Tuesday by overwhelmingly passing an Assembly Health Committee vote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden is meeting with Senate Democrats on Capitol Hill today for a lunchtime meeting to push for rewriting Senate rules to prevent Republicans from filibustering a pair of major voting rights bills, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act and the Freedom to Vote Act. On Wednesday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer outlined a plan to bring the voting bills to a debate using a parliamentary maneuver, but the move would still leave room for Republicans to block final passage of the bills using the filibuster. Two Senate Democrats have so far refused to support changing the filibuster rules, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. Biden heads to Capitol Hill 2 days after he gave a major speech on voting rights in Atlanta, Georgia. On Wednesday, Senate Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell blasted Biden's remarks.
12 months ago, this president said disagreement must not lead to disunion. But yesterday he invoked the bloody disunion of the Civil War, to demonize Americans who disagree with him. He compared, listen to this, a bipartisan majority of senators to to literal traitors. How profoundly unpresidential.
Democrats are increasingly concerned that Republicans will be able to successfully steal future elections, both on the national and state level, if major voting rights legislation is not immediately passed. During his speech in Atlanta, President Biden made reference to efforts by Donald Trump and his supporters to overturn the 2020 election.
We're here today to stand against the forces in America that value power over principle, forces that attempted a coup against the legally expressed will of the American people by sowing doubt, inventing charges of fraud, and seeking to steal the 2020 election from the people.
We're joined now by Ari Berman, a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. His new piece out just today, The Coming Coup, How Republicans Are Laying the Groundwork to Steal Future Elections. Ari, I want to start off by talking about what this maneuver is. Very complex, I'm sure, very hard for people to understand how the Democrats try to plan to get these bills on the floor and voted on in the Senate.
Good morning, Amy. Well, the plan is that the House is taking a bill and they are putting the two voting rights bills, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, in what's essentially a shell bill. They are going to pass that today and send it to the Senate. And that will allow the Senate to immediately debate the bill without needing 60 votes to get it to the floor. They will still need 60 votes to pass the bill if they don't reform the filibuster, but this will allow at least the Senate to immediately begin debating the bill, probably Friday or Saturday, and then set up a vote on these bills and also potentially changing the Senate rules on Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Which, of course, is Monday. I mean, this is really unusual. It's a bill completely unrelated, something to do with NASA that the House will pass. Then they will remove the text of that and put the two bills into it. And it's called a message that will be sent to the Senate as they do this. So then what has to happen next? And why are Manchin and Sinema key at the point in the Senate?
Yeah, and it's important to remember, Amy, these bills have already passed the House. So it's not like the House hasn't taken up the Freedom to Vote Act or the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act already. They just have to do this message bill to get to the Senate to essentially avoid 60 votes on debate. That's the only way that Schumer will be able to then have a debate on the bills themselves and on the rules changes. Manchin and Sinema are key because there's essentially 48 votes for changing the Senate rules to pass voting rights legislation, but they're two votes short. And the two votes they're short are Manchin and Sinema, and Democrats have been working feverishly, both publicly and behind the scenes, to get Manchin and Sinema to support the rules changes, but they're not there yet. It's important to remember, this voting rights bill, the Freedom to Vote Act, this is Joe Manchin's bill. This is not like Build Back Better, where he doesn't support the bill. He supports these bills. The question is he willing to change the rules to pass them? And as of now, the answer is no.
During his speech on Tuesday in Atlanta, President Biden made reference to Strom Thurmond, the longtime segregationist senator who served in the Senate for nearly half a century.
In 2006, the Voting Rights Act passed 390-33 in the House of Representatives and 98-0 in the Senate, with votes from 16 current sitting Republicans in this United States Senate. 16 of them voted to extend it. The last year I was chairman, some of my friends sitting down here will tell you, Strom Thurmond voted to extend the Voting Rights Act. Strom Thurmond. Think about that. The man who led the longest filibuster, one of the longest filibusters in history in the United States Senate, 1957, against the Voting Rights Act. The man who led and sided with all Southern bulls in the United States Senate to perpetuate segregation in this nation. Even Strom Thurmond came to support voting rights. But Republicans today are can't and won't. Not a single Republican has displayed the courage to stand up to a defeated president to protect America's right to vote. Not one.
So, Ari Berman, it looks like President Biden was trying to cut through all the bureaucracy as they talk about filibusters and everything else and just say, which side are you on, right? Strom Thurmond or John Lewis? Are you on the side of Jefferson Davis or Abraham Lincoln?
Exactly, Amy. He was trying to frame the fight for voting rights in moral terms, much like Lyndon Johnson did when he introduced the Voting Rights Act in 1965, saying this is a defining moment in American history and you have to pick a side. You can't just praise Martin Luther King on Martin Luther King Day. You have to live the values that Martin Luther King fought for, namely the values of the right to vote, which Martin Luther King called civil right number one. And I thought it was really interesting what the president said about Republicans previously supporting voting rights, because the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized four times, and every reauthorization was signed by a Republican president and supported by overwhelming bipartisan majorities in Congress. Now, that didn't mean every Republican liked the Voting Rights Act. Lots of GOP presidents like Nixon and Reagan didn't want to sign a reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, but there was such a strong bipartisan consensus for these bills that Republicans had no choice but to support them, and that's really evaporated. And obviously, so much of the attention has been on the Democrats and been on Manchin and Sinema to use their power to pass these bills, but Republicans have sort of gotten a free pass in terms of people really saying, how come you reauthorized the Voting Rights Act overwhelmingly in 2006, 390-33 in the House, 98-0 in the Senate? Mitch McConnell led the effort to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. And just two decades later, you are completely opposing a bill that you basically supported not too long ago.
So let's go broader with your piece that was just released as we went to air, The Coming Coup, How Republicans Are Laying the Groundwork to Steal Future Elections. You go beyond the issue of actually casting the ballot and how difficult that is, and you can lay that out around the country as well. Increasingly, 19 states passing more than 30 laws to restrict voting. But then the issue, for example, of gerrymandering and others.
That's right. I think the big trend over the last year has been the Republican Party's single-minded focus on instituting an insurrection through other means. They failed to overturn the 2020 election, so they're doing everything they can to rig and steal future elections through a toxic combination of voter suppression, extreme gerrymandering, and election subversion. And they're really trying to take over every aspect of the voting process. They've passed 34 new laws in 19 states, making it harder to vote, so they're making it harder to cast a ballot. They've passed all of these extreme gerrymandered maps in places like Texas and Georgia, which entrench the power of anti-democratic politicians. And then they've added all of these new election subversion laws that give Stop the Steal Republicans unprecedented power in states like Georgia over how elections are run and how votes are counted. And so they're really trying to take over every aspect of the election process to essentially try to succeed in 2022 and 2024, where they failed in 2020.
Talk about Lucy McBath, how you open your piece, a Congress member who we had on for years beforehand after her son was murdered by a white man.
I think this is really telling. Lucy McBath is a Black member of Congress from Georgia. She ran for the House in Georgia after her son, Jordan Davis, was murdered by a white man. Her victory in 2018 really opened the doors for the victories of Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff 2 years later. And what Republicans did is they gerrymandered her out of her congressional district. She represents a metro Atlanta area that has become a lot more diverse and a lot more Democratic. And they drew this district to go all the way up to the Appalachian Mountains and basically took out the most diverse and Democratic parts of her district and added in the most white and conservative parts of the state. And so what happened in Georgia is that all of the demographic change was from communities of color who increasingly lean Democratic, but the maps themselves reduced representation for communities of color, reduced representation for Democrats, and targeted Black members of Congress like Lucy McBath. And that is a form of election rigging, because if you can choose who your electorate is, then the elections themselves become essentially meaningless. So gerrymandering is one of the many tactics Republicans are using to consolidate power going into the midterm elections.
Talk about the victory against gerrymandering in Ohio that just happened.
Well, this was really significant because Ohio Republicans drew these flagrantly undemocratic maps where there was a bipartisan constitutional amendment passed by the voters in 2018 to rein in partisan gerrymandering. And then Republicans essentially hijacked this redistricting commission to draw these extreme gerrymandered maps that go exactly against what the voters wanted. And the Ohio Supreme Court struck it down with the one of the Republican judges siding with the Democrats and basically saying that the legislature not just needs to redraw these maps, but that in the future, voters might want to consider taking away the power of politicians to be able to draw their districts in the first place. So this was a significant victory, but it's going to be very hard to uphold these maps in most states. Ohio has a moderate state Supreme Court. North Carolina has a moderate state Supreme Court. But in Texas, in Georgia, in Florida, in other key states, the state Supreme Courts have moved far to the right. And the federal courts, because of the Supreme Court, has said we can't even review partisan gerrymandering. So it's going to be very difficult to fight gerrymandering through the courts writ large.
And can you talk about something that didn't get a heck of a lot of attention, the Cyber Ninjas, the company that led that partisan review of the 2020 ballots in Arizona, closing down following a scathing report by election officials and the threat of $50,000 fines a day. The report rebutting almost every claim this company made.
Well, yeah, the entire audit in Arizona was
a complete
– it cost millions of dollars in taxpayer money. At the end of the day, they reaffirmed Joe Biden's victory, so they weren't actually able to find any of the evidence of fraud. But I think they accomplished their job in the sense that after this review, Republicans were even more skeptical of the validity of the 2020 election compared to less skeptical. So just by airing all these conspiracy theories, they made the Republican Party more conspiratorial. And these same kind of quote-unquote audits are happening in other states, like in Wisconsin, where a very radically conservative state Supreme Court justice is threatening to jail election officials, threatening to subpoena the mayors of the largest cities, threatening to disband the state's election commission. So it's very scary what's happening here. And I think what's really new here is all of the efforts to subvert fair elections. We've seen voter suppression before. We've seen gerrymandering before. It's gotten worse, but we've seen it before. What's really new here are these efforts to take over how votes are counted. And that is the ultimate voter suppression method, because if you're not able to rig the election on the front end, you can throw out votes on the back end. And that is a very, very scary prospect for democracy.
For example, like in Arizona, Republicans stripped the Democratic Secretary of State, Katie Hobbs, of the power to defend state election laws and transferred that authority to the Republican Attorney General, but only through the 2022 election, just in case the partisan composition of the offices change. I mean, it is truly astounding. If you could comment on that, and another key point of your piece being that Trump and his allies are aggressive recruiting Stop the Steal-inspired candidates to take over other key election positions like Secretary of State, and also fiercely intimidating, going after election workers all over the country.
That's absolutely right, Amy. What we've seen is that both Democrats and Republicans who defended the integrity of the 2020 election have been purged from their positions, whether it's taking away the power of the Arizona Secretary of State to defend election lawsuits or removing the Republican Secretary of State in Georgia who stood up to Donald Trump, removing him as chair and voting member of the state election board. And the Washington Post had a recent article finding that 163 Republicans who've amplified the big lie are running for statewide positions with authority over elections. So positions like gubernatorial races, attorney general races, secretary of state races. And the Colorado Secretary of State, Jenna Griswold, told me this is akin to giving a robber a key to the bank. You are having people who say falsely the election was stolen running to oversee how elections are run. And so this is both a legal mechanism in that they're changing the laws in many states to make it easier to subvert elections, but it's also a political dynamic in that people who are election deniers are running to take over election operations in all of these key states. And when they get this power, who knows what they will do with it? Because I believe if you are willing to overturn the 2020 election for Trump, you are very likely going to be willing to overturn the 2022 and 2024 election for Republican candidates if it doesn't go in your favor.
Finally, Ari, if the bills are passed, the voting legislation in the Senate, could the U.S. Supreme Court overrule them? I mean, this is the Roberts Court, and John Roberts has been opposed to voting rights legislation throughout his career.
Absolutely, it's possible the Supreme Court could strike down these laws. But I think it's important to remember that Congress has authority under both the 15th Amendment and also under the core guarantees of the Constitution to write the rules of federal elections. So Congress has the power to pass these bills. Could the Supreme Court strike them down? Absolutely. The Supreme Court can clearly do whatever it wants at this point. It's gone so far. But I have to say, it's very ironic that Mitch McConnell wants there to be 60 votes to protect voting rights in the U.S. Senate, but he was able to put three justices on the Supreme Court for Donald Trump to take away voting rights with just 51 votes. So there's a fundamental asymmetry here that Republicans have been able to take away voting rights at both the state level and the federal level with 51 votes, but they want Democrats to have 60 votes to be able to protect voting rights in the U.S. Senate. And that's the fundamental asymmetry that has to change here.
Ari Berman, I want to thank you for being with us, senior reporter for Mother Jones. Then we'll link to your new cover story, The Coming Coup, How Republicans Are Laying the Groundwork to Steal Future Elections. Ari is the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, speaking to us from New Paltz, New York. Coming up, Confessions of a Human Guinea Pig. Stay with us.
Sunrise and sunset. Since the beginning, it hasn't changed yet. Some people fly. Can't see very clear when you're in flight. It's high time that you find the same people you misuse on your way up. You might meet them
on your way down. By the late Alan Toussaint, the New Orleans City Council recently voted to rename Robert E. Lee Boulevard to Alan Toussaint Boulevard. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Confessions of a Human Guinea Pig. Why I'm resigning from Moderna vaccine trials. That's the headline of an essay our next guest wrote in the medical news website Stat, which has gotten worldwide attention. He writes, quote, in July 2020, I volunteered to be in Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine trial. If I knew then what I know now about the company's quest for profits, I wouldn't have done that. He's now heard from dozens of other trial volunteers who share his concerns. They're launching a campaign today for other trial participants who want to get involved. Jeremy Menchik is associate professor at Boston University's Pardee School of Global Studies and joins us now for his first interview about his decision. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Menchik. Can you talk about why you first went in, how the study worked, and why you've decided to resign?
Good morning, Amy. Thank you so much for having me. I volunteered because, as you remember, March 2020 was a scary time. It was disorienting. And I thought anything that I could do to help, you know, get us out of this pandemic nightmare was an ethical imperative. You know, my wife is a nurse practitioner. She was working in Dorchester, the hardest hit part of Boston in terms of COVID-19. And so we face just imminent pressure from the virus. But on my way to work, I would drive by Longwood Medical Center. And living in Boston, you're very much aware of the power and the importance of these enormous hospitals and companies that are doing, you know, groundbreaking research on vaccines and other technologies. So I thought, you know, as a professor of international relations, I don't have much to contribute to public health, but I could donate my body. I could use my blood as a volunteer in the trial. trials, and I thought it would do some good.
I just want to ask you to take your microphone that you've put behind your head and put it in front of you. This is the what it is like to broadcast in a pandemic where people aren't in studios, but we're all makeshift and our guests are at home. We're talking to Jeremy Menchik, who wrote this piece in Stat News, Confessions of a Human Guinea Pig. So can you talk to... can you give your response to the Moderna CEO, Stefan Bancel, who said the company expects to record sales of about $18.5 billion from contracts for its COVID-19 vaccine and $3.5 billion from potential additional purchases, including booster shots updated for variants?
You know, if I could talk to the Moderna CEO, I would say two things. You know, first, I would say thank you. The technology, the mRNA technology, this is world-changing, life-saving technology. And I'm personally very grateful that I've been vaccinated, that I've been boosted, that one of my two kids has been vaccinated. I'm really looking forward to my two-year-old being vaccinated. And I am incredibly grateful for that technology. The second thing I would say, however, is use that enormous profit, right? The estimated profit revenue that Moderna is going to bring in 2022 is between $15 and $18 billion. Use that amazing profit to change the world, right? So that this vaccine isn't just a privilege for people in rich countries, right? But is truly part of the global effort to get us out of this pandemic nightmare. Because at current rates of production, Moderna's current rates of production, which they are keeping deliberately low, we're going to be in this pandemic nightmare for many years to come. But they have the ability to partner with other manufacturers, to license their technology to other manufacturers, to work with the WHO in order to dramatically scale up production. And that's really our only way out of this pandemic. The estimates by researchers is that we're going to need somewhere around 20 billion doses of mRNA vaccines because they are so much more efficacious than the other vaccines. We're going to need 20 billion doses in order to get out of this current state of affairs. And so it's incumbent on Moderna and on Pfizer to work with other manufacturers to scale up production, because current rates of production just aren't going to get us there. And this life-saving technology is going to be just the providence of rich people and rich countries.
So after your essay was published in Stat News, which is a really important news site for all issues vaccine-related, Forbes ran a response piece headlined, "Volunteer for Moderna's COVID-19 Vaccine Trial Regrets His Participation. That's a Problem." It was written by John LaMattina, who is a former president of Pfizer Global Research and Development. I want to get your response to his argument that, quote, "Unfortunately, Dr. Menchik's public repudiation of his participation in the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine clinical trial could serve to deter others from participation in future trials. Such behaviors could slow the development of the next generation of vaccines should a new viral outbreak occur. That would be a real tragedy. One that is avoidable." Professor Menchik, respond.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy. To be honest, I'm astounded by the reaction to my essay. It's a pretty personal essay. It was a little bit uncomfortable as an academic to write something like that. But the response has been, you know, really kind of shocking. I heard from guinea pigs around the Boston area and around the country, and to then be, you know, to have my article written up and critique in Forbes, and honestly, kind of a misleading way, was pretty shocking. And so I read the response in Forbes. I read it pretty carefully, and the conclusion I came to is what makes Pfizer uncomfortable, and I think what makes Moderna uncomfortable, is the idea that their data has a voice, that guinea pigs have a voice, and that we deserve to be represented You know, I think Pfizer and Moderna would like to be accountable only to their shareholders, only to markets, but that they have to be accountable to their guinea pigs, and they have to advance policies for public health, not just private profit. I think that's scary. I think that must be unnerving to them. And I think that's why the piece was, I have to say, misrepresented in Forbes. In response, we decided to scale up. You know, I think we found that mobilizing guinea pigs has tremendous potential for advancing positive social and political change. And that's why we're launching a website today, mrnaforall.org, where other guinea pigs can learn about the really problematic public health policies of Moderna and get involved. Because I think with mass mobilization and political participation, we can put pressure on Pfizer, we can put pressure on Moderna in a way that they never expected. And I think we can do a lot of good.
Last Thursday, a group of institutional investors representing $3.5 trillion in assets under management sent a letter to the executives of pharmaceutical companies like Moderna, calling on them to link their pay to making COVID-19 vaccines available around the globe. One of the backers, Frank Wagemans of Acmea Investment Management, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, told Reuters, quote, "It should make business sense for a vaccine manufacturer to aim to vaccinate the whole world." Your response?
You know, we should have learned after 9/11 that political unrest, that the actions of the U.S. military or any military around the globe could come back and could have blowback here in the U.S. I'm not sure we learned the lesson after 9/11, but we're learning it again now. If there's a new variant that pops up in Bangladesh or in Botswana, it's going to affect me in Boston, right? And we have to treat this pandemic as a global public health emergency and not just something where, as Americans who have access to the best vaccines in the world, we can be happy with that while leaving. You know, I worked for many years in Indonesia, and my friends, my colleagues in Indonesia are still using the Sinovac vaccine, which, you know, you're not going to hear it publicly, but it's much less efficacious in preventing hospitalization and preventing death. And so until my friends and colleagues in Indonesia have access to the mRNA vaccines, we're going to continue to see variants pop up around the world, whether it's in Bali or Bangladesh. It's going to affect me in Boston. And so we have to treat this pandemic as a global crisis, as a global public health emergency. And that means that Moderna needs to think about not just selling vaccines to rich countries and not just donating, you know, a few million vaccine, a few hundred million vaccines through the COVAX program, but seriously scaling up the technology so that the world can be vaccinated and boosted. And it's going to take billions more doses for that to happen. But that's what we all need. That's our way out of this nightmare.
Jeremy Mentrick, we want to thank you for being with us. We will link to your essay in Stat News, Confessions of a Human Guinea Pig, Why I'm Resigning from Moderna Vaccine Trials. Jeremy Mentrick is associate professor at Boston University's Party School of Global Studies. He's just launched a new campaign for other trial participants, as he calls them guinea pigs, who want to get involved. Next up, we speak to John Nichols. His new book, Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers, Accountability for Those Who Caused the Crisis. Stay with us.
It's a wonder how you feel at all. Oh, yeah. And it's a wonder.
It's a wonder
how it makes you. Oh yeah, I've been searching for the truth, but it can't be found in you no more. I know we got a difference.
know we do too. So let us grow. Oh yeah. Before you could barely see.
It's a Wonder by Curtis Harding. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at a new book detailing how hundreds of thousands of people died from COVID due to decisions of politicians like Mitch McConnell, pharmaceutical conglomerates, and a cabal of billionaires who exploited the pandemic for political advantage and personal enrichment. The book is titled Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers, Accountability for Those Who Caused the Crisis, by the nation's John Nichols. He's joining us now for more. John, welcome back to Democracy Now! Congratulations on the book that's coming out this month. You just listened to Professor Menchik talking about how he's gathering together other, as he calls them, guinea pigs, you know, human guinea pigs, who deeply believe that we had to come up with vaccines and so put their own bodies on the line, but are now seeing that they feel that their bodies were on the line for the profits of the pharmaceutical companies. Can you put this into a larger context?
I'm afraid I can. And first off, thanks for having me, Amy, and thanks for having me as part of this segment in particular, because I think the professor highlighted so much of what is at stake and also what's been happening. What I try to detail in the book and what I've written about a lot over the last 2 years is a painful reality. At the start of the pandemic, back in January and February of 2020, we knew about the shock doctrine. We knew about disaster capitalism. We had learned all of this from Naomi Klein and others. We had a clear picture of it. And yet, as this pandemic played out, we saw all of the worst aspects of disaster capitalism come into play. We saw, first and foremost, corporations and individuals who sought to advance themselves economically and in their share of markets. By cashing in on the fear, the concern, the crisis itself. We also saw politicians who aided and abetted this process at virtually every turn. The end result is that there is simply no question that hundreds of thousands of people who died in the United States did not have to die. The Lancet study from around a year ago suggests that roughly 40% of deaths in the first year of the pandemic were unnecessary. Dr. Deborah Birx, who was the White House kind of lead on this issue, has suggested that after the first 100,000 deaths, the deaths that came in later in 2020, in 2021 and beyond, were exponentially larger or higher than needed. And so we have this core reality that in the United States alone, hundreds of thousands of deaths occurred that did not have to occur. Globally, it's in the millions. And the U.S. could have played a huge role in addressing that.
So if you could name names, again, we're speaking with John Nichols of The Nation, and his book is coming out now. That's called Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers. In February 2021, Pfizer announced, you write in your book, the company announced it expected to take in $15 billion from vaccine sales during the course of the year, the COVID-19 vaccine now accounting for nearly a quarter of Pfizer's profits.
That's right. And in fact, at the end of the year, it turned out to be much more with Pfizer, Moderna, and other companies. The People's Vaccine Project has estimated that Pfizer, Moderna, and BioNTech are taking in $1,000 a second, $65,000 a minute in profits from these vaccines. So it's just almost jaw-dropping, the amount of money that they're taking in. This has been a huge benefit to these companies. These vaccines, which were developed with tremendous amounts of assistance from the U.S. government and from multinational, multilateral groupings, have turned out to be their leaders and their prophets. They are making, you know, overwhelming amounts of money as a result of this. And yet, at the same time, they are refusing to make their vaccine strategies and approaches available through to other countries. They're also seeking at every turn to maximize their profits in the United States. And the painful reality here is that there's very little accountability. There's very little efforts by Congress and by watchdogs outside. There are watchdog groups that have done tremendous work, but by federal and state watchdogs that should be involved here to hold these companies to account and to force them to, A, make their vaccines more available, and B, to recognize that these excess profits go way beyond the bounds.
I mean, you have, for example, Oxfam saying in 2021, May 2021, so it's beyond that now, COVID vaccines create 9 new billionaires with combined wealth greater than the cost of vaccinating the world's poorest countries. John Nichols, President Biden could force this with Moderna because the U.S. taxpayer money was used to develop the vaccine.
That's exactly right. And in fact, President Biden has certainly done a better job than Donald Trump. There's no question of that. But he has not begun to go to the levels that he should, and nor has Congress, on forcing these companies, which took tremendous advantage of the moment and which, frankly, got tremendous amounts of support from the U.S. government, literally numbering in the tens of billions of dollars in support and contracts, to show some sort of responsibility. This is not a new concept. In the past, we have had pharmaceutical companies that bent to the reality, either by pressure from government or essentially some sort of moral instinct, that they cannot take these sorts of excess profits in a moment like this. And you did mention also a moment ago billionaires. And it's important to understand that, you know, thanks to the work of the Institute for Policy Studies and Americans for Tax Fairness and others, we now know that during the course of this pandemic, billionaires have exponentially increased their wealth. And some of these are folks associated with the pharmaceutical industry, but across all industries, to the point where, you know, the number of billionaires increased from, and this is a study from last year, from 614 in the United States to 745. And that their increase in wealth during the course of the year, you know, took them, you know, literally into the trillions of dollars of advanced wealth for these individuals. And again, we just have not had an accountability moment.
John, we were just showing images. We're showing images of Jeff Bezos. How does he profit?
Oh, Jeff Bezos, who gets a chapter in the book, and the book features 18 chapters, short essays, on examples of where people took advantage of or played politics with this crisis and have not been held to account for that, although perhaps we could say Donald Trump was by his defeat in 2020. But I look at all these individuals, and Bezos is one of them. You know, for Bezos, you've actually highlighted some of the ways in which Bezos took advantage of this. There were, early on in the pandemic, individuals who worked in Amazon warehouses who said, look, this is a problem. We have people who are getting sick. We have people whose lives are being put at risk, and there need to be much greater protections. And as you know, some of those individuals were fired simply for raising the alarm. At the same time, there have been unions that have sought to increase protections in Amazon warehouses. Amazon has fought at every turn to prevent those unions from coming into and organizing at those warehouses. At the same time, Jeff Bezos' wealth has extended to such an extent that there is now open speculation that he may be the first trillionaire in the United States or in the world. And beyond that, he's shooting himself up into space, you know, on you know, personal adventures at a time when frontline workers are still getting sick, dying, and suffering as a result of the challenges posed by this pandemic.
Can you tell us the story of Michael Jackson, where you begin your book, who is in your home state of Wisconsin?
Sure. In each of the chapters in the book, I try to look at individuals who got sick or died and to try and explore all the politics and the profiteering that went on that might have actually prevented those deaths or at least made things better. And Mike Jackson was a worker at a Briggs & Stratton plant in the Milwaukee area where they made lawn care products. And he was deemed an essential worker because I guess lawn care was essential. And went to his plant on a regular basis. He had a large family, which he was working hard to support. And he got sick. And instead of having the protections that were needed, first off, before he got sick, I should emphasize that he and others had raised the alarm. And in so many cases, there are frontline workers and workers in vulnerable situations who raise the alarm through their unions or individually. And he wasn't paid attention to. And then when he did get sick, he was escorted out of the plant at one point, but then was back in a couple of days working again. He finally collapsed at his machine, and he ended up dying a few days later. His death was, one of many in that kind of in those initial stages of the pandemic. What happened in Milwaukee, though, and what was really encouraging, is that grassroots groups took the example of that death and really highlighted it and made it a part of a movement, a call for workplaces to do much more to protect workers and, frankly, for government to intervene. And if I can just emphasize at this point, there were a lot of protections that went in, emergency protections that went in for frontline workers and workers in manufacturing and other settings. Many of those protections now have fallen away. And so in many cases, we have workers today who don't have the protections that they had in early stages of the pandemic. What we need desperately is an accountability moment where we recognize that people like Mike Jackson probably didn't have to die, and that their deaths should not be in vain. We should have permanent protections for workers.
John Nichols, very quickly, why did you devote a whole chapter to Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law?
Because he did an incredibly lousy job on running the supply chain. And there was a critical moment in which it was clear we didn't have the supplies that we needed. And there were ways in which to get those supplies, to do domestic manufacturing, to do, good deals for importation. Instead, Jared Kushner was put in charge of it. It was such a disaster that even back in 2020, just months into his oversight of the supply chain issues, he was under investigation by Congress. They finally folded the program he was involved in because, like just about everything else Jared Kushner touched during the Trump administration, this thing fell apart.
I'm wondering how you respond, and we just have a minute, to arguments that, you're just really an anti-vaxxer. Even the same with Professor Menchik, attacking him as that. How you can be pro-vaccine but anti-profiteering?
I thank God for the vaccines. I am double vaccinated and boosted, and if there's another booster coming, I'm going to be first in line to get it. I think these are incredibly vital to saving people's lives at this point and going forward. And the fact of the matter is, I want these vaccines to be available to everyone, not blocked via profiteering and failed government policies. I want them available to everyone in the United States and around the world. And I know from doing this book that that is possible.
John Nichols, I want to thank you for being with us, the nation's national affairs correspondent. His new book, coming out later this month, Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers, Accountability for Those Who Cause the Crisis. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for Human Resources Manager. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Felsmeyer-Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maratio Sena, Tammy Warrenoff, Sharina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tay Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlon, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. Stay safe.